Indeed, it is a great day to honor the Lord as we honor our moms. And we have some famous, very influential, very powerful people among us today. Some of the most powerful people in the world, in fact, are here. I'd like you to meet a few of them. Moms, would you stand? All of our mothers, stand and remain standing. Look at this. Oh, my goodness. We are among celebrities today. Indeed, we are. Remain standing, moms. I knew you were going to do that. I knew that because moms just have a tendency to go, yeah, here I am, and sit back down. This is all I wanted. But we want to give you a little bit more. We want to tell you everything in that video is true, and we could run it a whole lot longer. But we know and understand and are very grateful for your godly influence in the lives of the next generation, the ones you're raising, perhaps the one that you're secondarily raising grandkids and maybe even great-grandkids. And we know and understand, as we're going to see in the text today, your influence is incredible. Thank you for investing in the next generation. God bless you, moms. We love you. We appreciate you. Amen. I just wanted you to see some of those who are in the fight and who are working to raise the next generation of godly young men and women, and who haven't retired when their children started raising their children, but they've stayed invested, second generation, third generation. I just love to see godly Christian moms fighting, praying, sharing, working, investing, telling the story of Jesus to the upcoming generations, because you really are helping to shape the future of this nation and of this world and certainly of our church and community. Thank you and God bless you. And our text today is in Judges chapter 2. And it's a bit of a carryover from last week. And I want to pick this up, and I think you'll see how it fits in perfectly with moms, because one of the things I know about mothers is they are far-sighted. And I don't mean that as a diagnosis of eyesight. I mean that they have vision. They understand implications. They know what is to come, and they have a passion and a desire to see good come and godliness come in the generations over which they have influence. And my goodness, we sure need that godly influence today. In this text today, Judges chapter 2, beginning in verse 6, we find Israel in a difficult and rather dark period of time. They've come through the conquest. Some years have passed now, and the major battles have been won. The victories have been many, and the back of the enemy, so-called, is broken. But the job is not done, because now it's time to distribute the land by allotment. And the command is, as we'll see in the text, that they should go to their particular inheritance and finish the job of driving out the inhabitants of the land, and therefore to secure forever the land of promise, and to live in that land of promise, and to enjoy the benefits and the blessings of God's promises through every generation. Well, at least that's how it's supposed to work. But if you'll notice in verse 6, chapter 2, Judges, when Joshua dismissed the people of Israel went each to his inheritance to take possession of the land. That was the plan. And the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had seen all the great work that the Lord had done for Israel. And this is a generation of commitment. A generation of commitment. And Joshua, the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died at the age of 110 years old. They buried him within the boundaries of his inheritance in Timnath-Heres in the hill country of Ephraim, north of the mountain of Gaash. And all that generation also were gathered to their fathers. Stop. Because this is a generation worth noting. This is what I would call a generation of spiritual leaders or of spiritual commitment. They knew the Lord. They knew the Lord. Their experience with Yahweh was rooted in personal experience, not just the history books of the Hebrews. They had walked with God. They experienced firsthand His power and His presence. They knew what God could do because they'd seen God accomplish great things in and through them. And they were beyond convinced that God is God and there is no other. And they boldly proclaimed it. In fact, if you have a Bible, turn back a little bit to Joshua 24. You probably are familiar with this passage. You should be. We, in fact, have these verses painted on the wall of our kitchen where we spend most of our awake time, as you could tell. We like the kitchen in the Fleming house, me anyway. And there it says across the wall, and it's been there in every home we've had, it's been on the wall. Because it is a declarative statement of a generation. Here it is. And if it's evil in your eyes to serve the Lord, you choose. Choose this day whom you will serve. Sound familiar? Whether the gods of your fathers who served in the region beyond the river or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell. But as for me and my house, this is a generational statement of value and of purpose and of priority. Joshua says, for me and my house, you're going to live under my roof, boy. Not exactly like that. As for me and my house, we will, say it with me, serve the Lord. I'm just curious, how many of you have that hanging or posted somewhere in your home? Let me see. Yeah, that's absolutely right. We have it in our home because we've made a similar declarative statement in our home to the next generation that we've had the privilege to raise up within the walls of our home. We've said to them their whole lives, someday you'll make a grown-up decision. And let me tell you what that decision is going to be. We are going to serve the Lord. In fact, we don't just have it vinyled on the wall in the kitchen or hanging in a portrait in the other rooms. We have it on the base, on the foundation, on the concrete foundation of our home. We put it on the slab and we said, we want to make this declarative statement. We want you to know, next generation of Flemings coming up, that we have the responsibility to not only raise in the physical, practical sense, but to nurture and disciple in the spiritual sense. This house belongs to Jesus, and we are committed to Him, and we're going to serve the Lord. Joshua's generation, a generation of commitment, who made a bold and declarative statement, a call, an invitation, if you will. You all gonna make up your own minds, Joshua said, but let me tell you something. We've made up our minds. We've made a firm decision. I love that. I just love decision makers. I like decisive people. It makes me nervous to be around folks who change their mind every day. I can follow somebody. I'm a good follower. I just need you to make up your mind and decide where we're going. This turning around every day, depending on which way the wind's blowing, these opinion polls and popularity polls and all of this pressure, I just want to know, what have you decided? What have you made up your mind concerning? What are your core convictions? What are you going to stand on? What are you going to build your life on? What are you going to raise the next generation of young people believing? What is your passionate, foundational commitment? I don't know about you, Joshua says, but as for me and my house, it's done. It's decided. It's in the concrete, baby. We're going to serve the Lord. And come what may, no matter what happens on good days and bad days, it's not up to how I feel or what the newsman says. It's not about popular opinion or being politically correct. I'm telling you right now, the decision's been made, the die is cast. We're going to serve the Lord, and that's final. Do you understand what I'm saying to you, son? This is a non-negotiable. Now, there's a generation in our text that took that approach to life and living and to raising the next generation with the understanding we will serve the Lord. But along behind them comes another generation. We might call this a generation of compromise. They knew about the Lord, but not necessarily the Lord. We know they're there because of the verse I'm about to read to you now is so concerning. There has to be something in between what we just read and what we're about to read. But let me go ahead and jump forward and read it. Verse 10 again, and all that generation also were gathered to their fathers. And there arose a generation after them who did not know the Lord, nor the work that he had done for Israel. Now, stop for a moment there, because there must be in here somewhere behind a generation of absolute determination, decision, and commitment who knew the Lord, a generation of compromise who merely knew about the Lord. This is the up-and-coming generation. Now, they didn't follow other gods. They didn't fall down and worship other gods, no. But let me tell you what they didn't do. They didn't drive out the other gods from their land and from their territories and from their peoples, nope. We know that because in Joshua chapter or Judges chapter 1, we have a bit of a description of how things began to fall apart in the promised land. Look at verse 28, just curiously. When Israel grew strong, they put the Canaanites to forced labor, but did not drive them out completely. Now, what was the commandment of God? Drive them out completely. Now, in our Western mindset, we have a hard time reckoning. We wonder, did God really, how's that work? But see, we don't quite understand what was happening here and why and the importance of cleansing the land of this idolatry and paganism. But in a few minutes, when I read to you a summary statement from Psalm 106, it might help you a little bit more to understand why God said you must drive these people from the land. You cannot allow their influence to remain. You cannot compromise with this evil. It cannot be done. You will lose. But they did not obey. Verse 29, and Ephraim did not drive out the Canaanites, so they lived among them. Verse 30, Zebulun didn't drive out the inhabitants, so they lived among them and became subject to forced labor. So here's what this generation must have concluded. They're not that bad. And besides, we're strong and we can control it. Here you have this evil influence of the Canaanite idolatry and paganism and the worship of Baals and the Ashtaroth, these false gods, and the horrific immorality and the ungodliness that resulted through worship of these things. And they said, well, there's more of us than there are of them. We've subjugated them. We can use them. They'll be useful. And they won't influence us negatively because we're strong. We're the people of God. We can handle it. You know what the answer to that is, right? Wrong. Wrong. They were commanded to drive them out because of the danger of compromise. They didn't do it. I'll quote from Warren Wiersbe. He said this, the sin in our lives we fail to conquer will eventually conquer us. Today's complacency is tomorrow's captivity. I saw on the, I don't know how many of you watch, you might feel sinful if you watch, I don't know. I just like watching it. I didn't bet. The Kentucky Derby yesterday. Did you? Looks like you were there, Miss Carolyn. You got the hat and everything. Did you see it? Did anybody watch that? I like the human interest pieces, so I watched it for an hour or so before the race, and I was just really struck by one particular interview. There's a jockey, and since they played it on national television, you won't mind me reminding you or telling you what was said. But here's this guy who is having one last chance to race and to ride a horse. He's a jockey. And he's had an up and down career, although he's been very successful. I think they said he'd won 3 Kentucky Derbies already. But he has a hard time getting and keeping a job and staying on mounted on a horse because he has a drinking problem. And his alcohol gets in the way of his judgment and his work ethic, and it's caused all kinds of problems, and he keeps losing jobs and he can't get a mount. And then they interview him and he says this, I don't have a problem with alcohol. And I thought, how tragic and how troubling. Everyone in your life is saying you have a problem with alcohol and your career is going down the drain and you're having one last ditch effort. Your brother's giving you a final chance to ride a horse and still you say you can handle it. Listen to me. Today's compromise and complacency is tomorrow's captivity. We sometimes think that we can handle it, that we can control it, that we'll keep it in its place and it won't ultimately hurt us. How many people have made those little compromises that ended up opening up the dam of evil influence and just flooded over them? How many people said, I can handle it. It's just a little. It's not bad. It's not much. I'm strong. Only to be run over completely because they didn't remove it completely from their lives. I sometimes wonder where in our homes, moms and dads, let's think about this from a parent's perspective for a minute. Where in our homes are we compromising our convictions and creating the opportunity for a little pet something to become a giant predator? Where in our homes have we decided to compromise and therefore to create an opportunity for evil to exist and to grow? Maybe you've heard it said this way, one generation accepts it in moderation, the next generation accelerates it. In excess. Sometimes I hear parents, Christian parents, patting themselves on the back because of their open-mindedness and to see their kids run headlong into rebellion. And I think, if you could do that over again, would you tighten it up just a little bit? Would you close the windows tight? Would you batten down the hatch? Would you say, this is our home and this is God's house and this is a holy place and we're not going to tolerate evil and ungodliness in this house because in this house we've made a decision. We will serve the Lord. That is compromise. That's not acceptable. We will not tolerate that. We're not going to open up this little gate and let the flood come in. Hello? I wonder if sometimes that little bit of compromise is all it takes. You know the saying, you give the devil an inch and he takes a mile. He comes in easy, goes out hard. So here we have a generation of compromise. They went through the motions, no doubt. They knew about the Lord. They heard the stories. They obviously practiced the religion of their parents if they did not know practically the Lord of their religion. They lived on the experiences of a previous generation. They did not drive out the inhabitants of the land. They compromised. Therefore, their worship was impure and corrupted. Therefore, their relationship deteriorated into form religion. Careful. These are the kids who had to go to church. These are the young people who had to go because dad said, as long as you live under my roof, you're going to church. So they did. And they sat in the back and drew pictures and took notes and took naps, but they never took the relationship. This is a generation of compromise. It's funny to me how many people say, when I was young, I was made to go to church. I had to go to church. Now I'm old. I don't have to go, so I don't go anymore. And I think, well, I hope you still brush your teeth. Right? I mean, I don't know about you, but there were lots of things I had to do as a child that I get to do as an adult, and I'm glad I do, and my wife is especially glad I do. A generation of compromise. Religious, but no relationship. And then arose this third generation, if you will, and I know it can't be applied in specifics, a generational cohort, but there is a slide here, don't you see? There's a generational slide. There's a deterioration of conviction here because a generation of commitment gives way to a generation of compromise, which gives way to a generation of corruption. They did not know the Lord. Look at this again, verse 10. And all that generation also were gathered to their fathers, and there arose another generation after them who did not know the Lord or the work that he had done for Israel. They did not know the Lord. They didn't possess their grandparents' relationship. They didn't even practice their parents' religion. They did not know him. Now, that word in the Bible's language, translated here, know, as in an informational sense, which is certainly possible. It could be just simple ignorance. They didn't know because a compromising generation didn't tell them the stories, didn't introduce them to the God they did not know. They were a compromising generation. Maybe it made them feel guilty to tell the third generation what the first generation had said because the second generation wasn't living up to those standards. Hello, am I getting in anybody's house yet? Let me say that again. It could be that the third generation didn't know anything because the second generation that knew some things wasn't willing to tell it because those things would make them seem like they were guilty. I think I'm about to hurt some feelings. I don't mean to. I'm just thinking, though. Because we got a generation of commitment gives way to a generation of compromise, gives way to a generation they did not know. Now, it could be that they just informationally didn't know, they were unaware, they're just simple ignorance. Or it could be, in fact, that word is translated in Proverbs 3:6, not as did not know, but acknowledge, to acknowledge. So it may be more than simple unbelief. It may be sinister unbelief. They did not know, meaning they would not acknowledge. They didn't want anything to do with. It may not necessarily mean it could be in some situations, but in others it could be simply this: I don't want to hear it. I've heard all I want to hear. I don't want to hear any more about this God, this Yahweh. I don't want to know anything else about all those old stories and all that old-fashioned religion stuff. This is a new day. We're a new generation. We're living in a new land. We need new gods for a new day. Could be. Just sinister, abject unbelief. But either way, the case is the same. Look what it says. And they did evil in the sight of the Lord. Verse 11. And the people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and they served the Baals. Look what else they did. They abandoned the Lord, the God of their fathers, who had brought them out of the land of Egypt. They went after other gods from among the gods of the peoples who were around them, the Canaanite gods, and bowed down to them. That means to subject oneself and to serve. And they provoked the Lord to anger. Well, of course they did. They abandoned the Lord and served the Baals and the Ashtaroth. The Baals, the fertility gods, and they're regional. There's a little different twist in each little area and region. And the Ashtaroths, their female counterparts. These are the gods of sexual immorality. and abject evil and ungodliness, as we'll see in just a moment. I'll share with you a descriptive statement of what Israel did when they joined the religion of the Canaanites from Psalm 106. Either way, Yahweh to this generation was just another God to choose from, and they chose another God. Shocking. Unbelievable. They turned their backs on the one true and living God and chose instead to worship and serve these Baals and these Ashtaroth, to fall down before them and to participate in this ungodly fertility cult of worship. And what did they do? Psalm 106 gives us a bit of a description of God's working with the people of Israel. I come to 106, verse 34 of the psalm, and notice this. They did not destroy the peoples, they being Israel, as the Lord commanded them. They did not obey. The generation of compromise was sent to clear out the territories that they had inherited, but they did not do it. They let them remain. They lived with them and among them, and their influence was corrupting. Verse 35 says, they mixed with the nations and learned to do as they did. Wow. They served their idols, which became a snare to them. They sacrificed their sons and their daughters to the demons. They poured out innocent blood, the blood of their sons and daughters, whom they sacrificed to the idols of Canaan, and the land was polluted with blood. Thus they became unclean by their acts and played the whore in their deeds. Then the anger of the Lord was kindled against his people, and he abhorred his heritage. He gave them into the hand of the nations so that those who hated them ruled over them. Wow, can you believe it? I mean, it's one thing to judge the Canaanites for their ungodliness and for their evil practices, but we're not talking about Canaanites now. We're talking about compromising Israelites who did what the Canaanites did. Wow, you want to talk about peer pressure. Sometimes that's where compromise will lead, to corruption. What a shame. I don't know if they felt like maybe Yahweh was an old-fashioned God for a past generation in a previous place and time. I don't know how you rationalize and reason. Somewhere in here is a disconnect. Somewhere in here, communication fails. Somewhere in here, compromise replaces conviction and commitment, and the result is just utter corruption. Can you imagine Joshua looking over this scene? Can you imagine his shock and surprise? Can you imagine Moses seeing this? Can you imagine God having to see this? A generation of conviction to a generation of compromise to an absolute corrupt generation that did not know the Lord nor what he had done. I'm telling you something right now, folks. If you look around, you'll see evidences of that generation. Do you know what the fastest growing group or demographic in America is today with regard to religious practice? Are you ready? None. Nuns. N-O-N-E-S. Nuns. Those who indicate by faith preference, none. Nuns are the fastest growing segment. None. They did not know the Lord, nor the work that he had done. They don't know. Having dinner a year or so ago in a restaurant, I was talking to a young executive graduate of one of the most famous colleges, universities in the world, brilliant mind, vice president of a major company, a technology company. I had the privilege to have dinner with him with some friends. And of course, as I was getting to know him, I always want to know about his religious background. He didn't have one. His parents didn't have one. But his grandmother did go to church, he said. And when I asked him about his personal belief and convictions, he said, well, you know, that seems to me old-fashioned. He used the word old-fashioned, that sort of old-fashioned. That's what my grandmother did. That's what my grandparents believed. But me, my generation, he said, he was pretending to speak for his generation, which I'm happy to say, you cannot generalize this generation. You cannot. But this young man was trying to speak for a large cohort, a large generation of people, and said, that whole religion and faith in God and Jesus thing was great for my grandparents. They needed that. Perhaps for my parents, except that they didn't go, didn't know, didn't take me. So I have no religious background or experience. And I don't even know what I'm missing. That stuff is something for my grandparents. Can I just tell you something? There are some things I'm glad went out of style. Like outhouses. There is nothing in me that longs for the outhouses. Is you? You with me? I mean, no. I mean, I actually like indoor plumbing. And I like central heat and air. And I like electricity in every room. And I like satellite and cable TV. I like the computer and the internet. I'm all for it. I'm all for it. I'm sort of glad some things went out of style. I'm sort of glad some fads have come and gone. It scares me sometimes when I see the 70s coming back around again. If you ever see me wearing a real wide tie, all right, it means I have caved in. I just avoid fads and fashions that come and go. But let me tell you something. Let me tell you what I said to that young, sharp, educated, brilliant executive leader among his generation. I said, well, the question is this. Not is it popular or in style, but is it true? That's the question a smart guy like you has to answer for himself. Regardless of your grandparents or your parents or your entire generation, the question you have to answer for yourself is it true? Because if it's true, it never goes out of style. If it's true, it's as relevant today as it was in your grandmother's day or in Moses' day. You've got to answer the question if it's true. And let me tell you what this generation is struggling with. They want to know what is true. It's a shame there aren't enough people in the previous generations that are sitting them down and talking to them at a young enough age to say, let me tell you what's true. It drives me crazy. I want to scream every time I hear a parent say, I don't make my kids go to church. I want them to be able to make up their own minds. I'm not a violent man. But occasionally, you don't bring your kids to church because you want them to make up their own mind. Let me tell you what you've done by default. You've made up their mind for them. You've demonstrated by your negligence that you believe there is no God, that he is not relevant today, and that your children shouldn't trust him, love, and obey him. Did you hear that guy give a testimony last week? He said, I was an atheist, and I didn't have a problem going to church because my father was an atheist, and he took me to church every Sunday just to be nice to my mother. So I knew he could be an atheist and still go to church, and I was good at it till he was 35 years old. One generation passing down what they believe, what they know and understand through what they practice to the next generation. You see what's happening here? Moms, you with me on this? I know your heart. I know a mother is fierce for the following generations. And here we see in the scriptures in Judges chapter 2, a deteriorating culture from a generation of commitment to compromise to corruption. And we see the consequences. They never go out of style either, you know? Some things are always true. If you honor the Lord and bless the Lord, he'll bless and honor you. If you disobey the Lord and reject the Lord, guess what? The consequences are still true. Look at verse 14 to 15. Let's see what happens here. So the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel. Really? You mean he didn't wink and nod and say, oh, that's okay, I love you anyway? You mean it wasn't okay with him that his people turned his back on them and adulterated themselves at the altars of Baal and the Ashtaroth? You mean that God was actually offended by their sin? The anger of the Lord kindled against them. That's the first evidence of consequences here, a just and right response from a holy God. What should we expect from a holy God? That sin is in itself by nature rebellion and rejection of a holy God. So we can choose sin or we could choose God, but you cannot do both. Look what else happened. And he gave them over to the plunderers who plundered them. He gave them over. He gave them what they wanted. They received the freedom they desired, and they used their choice to reject him. But along with that came rejection of his presence and of his power and of his provision. Yeah, how many times have you heard people say, where is God? Where is God? Yeah, for 50 years we've been telling God to go away, and suddenly a lot of more people are wondering, where is God? What if he gave us what we wanted? What if he answered our prayer? What if he answered our request? What if he said, okay, I created you with a moral ability to choose. You have chosen to reject me. I'll step back and let you have what you want. Now we're getting what we want, and guess what? We don't want what we get. Where is God? How many people blaming God today who told God yesterday, We got this. Look what happened. He gave them over to the plunderers who plundered them. They couldn't stand. He sold them into the hand of their surrounding enemies so that they could no longer withstand their enemies. Because they rejected God's presence, therefore they rejected his power and the provision that they required. Look what else happened. God opposed them. Whenever they marched out, verse 15, the hand of the Lord was against them for harm. Wow. You mean this God who covenanted with them and committed to be with them and that no one could stand against them is now himself standing against them? Now, that'll mess with somebody's theology in here, no doubt. But remember, I've been telling you all the while here, there's this universal aspect of God's covenant to Abraham, which he has covenanted himself, that is unconditional. But within that universal umbrella of God's redemptive activity, there is this daily relationship or the working out of that relationship, and God's blessings are contingent upon our willingness to bless God. God has not one time obligated himself to bless our disobedience or rebellion. Why would he? That would be to foster our destruction. And he loves you more than to let you go into destruction. So God turns on them. And wait a minute, let's just go ahead and get the positions right here. God opposed them. Listen to this. If we choose God's enemy, then we make ourselves an enemy of God. God doesn't move. God didn't change sides. God hasn't changed directions. It's we who move. They rejected God and chose God's enemy. Therefore, they made themselves an enemy of God. And of course, he opposed them. And should it have surprised them? Look what it says. As the Lord had warned them, and the Lord had sworn to them, they should have known. God here is being faithful to himself and to his purposes and to his nature. But not only that, God is exercising here divine discipline, which is always redemptive and ultimately corrective. You see, these are God's people, and he's not going to let them wander off into oblivion through destruction. He's going to work to redeem them as a people. And so the summary statement is, the last verse of verse 15, they were in terrible distress, which is where sin leads us when we follow. Hebrews 12 reminds us of the chastening of the Lord because of his love for us. He disciplines the one he loves. He chastens or chastises every son whom he receives. And what we see here is God dealing harshly yet redemptively with his people to correct their behavior. That's divine discipline, and it is ultimately redemptive, always redemptive. In fact, we as Christians, we as believers, children of God, we should recognize the discipline of God, his chastising, and welcome it because it is a statement of his fatherhood over us. How many moms in this room? How many moms in this room disciplined your children or discipline your children because you love them? Because you're concerned about them and because you know that that direction will lead them into harm, into destruction, and you love them too much to let them go. So you do the hard work of a mother and you discipline them, and they fuss at you and they make ugly eyes at you and they tell other people bad things about you, but you stand up and you bow up and you say, well, you can say all you want to, but you ain't getting away with that. I love you too much to let you go. Courageous parenting is this, that we do not shield our children from the consequences of their actions. Did you hear me? I'm telling you, in this day and time, in this era, we have people who must have master's degrees in denying their children's responsibility or culpability. Not my child. No way. He did not. He would never. Yeah, he did. And you should not only admit, acknowledge it, but you should take him home and deal with it. Because you are harming your child. You are harming your child if you do not let that child understand and embrace and deal with the consequences of their actions. They will grow up to believe there are no consequences for their actions, and you will handicap that child for life. Let that child suffer the consequences. Oh, it just breaks my heart. It makes him sad. Yeah, it's supposed to. It's how he learns not to do those things. It's how she learns not to say those things when they suffer a little. Because you see, we deprive our children of little consequences and they grow up to make major decisions and major mistakes thinking there are no major consequences. And then they sit back. This generation's amazing. This generation sits back and go, what? What's the problem? Because we have shielded and protected them from consequences. Can I tell you the most courageous prayer Beverly and I have ever prayed over our children? I bet you know what it is. It takes a lot of courage to pray this prayer we've discovered. Lord, have your way. Do whatever you need to do, Lord, to have your will and your way in our children's lives. That is a tough prayer to pray. But when you can't follow them around anymore, you know, when you can't get away with a GPS on the bumper and you can't sneak a camera in their car and you can't go wherever they go and sneak through the bushes and peek at them, when you can't be where they are and do and see what they're doing, at some point you just got to hand them over to the Lord. And here's what we've always prayed over our kids. Catch them, Lord. Yeah, catch them. Drives our son crazy. We've prayed over him his whole life. Lord, don't let him get away with a single thing. Catch him every time. And sure enough, that kid gets caught every time. He's at times lamented the fact that he can't get away with anything. And we say, God is good. He has answered our prayer. Because we've prayed that for our kids. We have prayed, Lord, don't let them get away with any little thing. Or they'll grow up thinking that there aren't any big consequences to big things. Lord, hunt them down and hem them in and help them out. Courageous parenting, moms. It's not when you shield your children and take the brunt of the blow of the consequences yourself. Courageous parenting is when you push that little boy or that little girl forward and say, he did it. Yeah, he did it. And he's about to suffer for it. Now, I'll let you define suffering. There are lots of ways to do that. I don't have a preferred way. I just know it takes a courageous mom and a courageous dad who are willing to say, Lord, I want to partner with you in shaping the life of this young person, this young adult, this growing adult who has children of their own. I'm going to stay engaged and I'm going to stay in the fight and I'm going to be a part of raising the next generation. And over my dead body, is there going to be a generational slide in my family tree? Hello? Thank you for that. Well, I'll close with a voice and a word of hope. Verse 16 says this, then the Lord raised up judges who saved them out of the hand of those who plundered them. Judges to deliver, to save, like Othniel and Ehud and Shamgar. I encourage you to read those stories. They're amazing, especially Ehud. I love that story. But then there's Deborah in chapter 4 and 5 of Judges, who was born into an evil generation of Israelites, and yet she arose as a mother, quoting from her song, over Israel. She mothered Israel. She stopped the generational slide. She is one of those who said, we're going to turn this thing around, folks. She's one of those who said, there's not going to be any compromise in my house. She's one of those who stood on her convictions and said, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Deborah. Just one of many women that God raised up in times of great need. We remember Esther, who for such a time as this came into the kingdom. Of course, we remember Mary, the mother of Jesus. In the New Testament, we remember Lois and Eunice, who raised young Timothy. Never underestimate, mom, your power. Never underestimate your influence as a godly mother and woman over the coming generations. You are still raising up godly generations. You are still standing in the gap, refusing to allow the generations behind you to slide into corruption through compromise. You, mom, that's the difference you make. And what can we do, moms, dads too, what can we do? Let me suggest three quick applications. Number one, ensure that what you have is real and not just religion. It's impossible to pass down something you don't possess. Make sure that what you have is real and not just routine religion. Because you cannot describe a God to your children you do not know. They will not recognize him through secondhand testimony. Make sure what you have is real. Number two, lead by living out your authentic faith for all to see. Because no matter what you profess, it's what you practice that teaches the greatest lessons. So make sure those generations come along behind you, see you living out your real faith on a daily basis, because they're going to want to know, what does that look like? What does that look like? You show them. And third and last, fight. Fight for the next generation's authentic faith experience. Don't defer. Fight through prayer on your knees. Fight through your testimony. Tell them what God has done. Tell them what you know of His wonder and His glory. Make an investment in the next generation. Continue to invest in them and stay engaged in the fight for them. Here's what we must not do. We must not retreat. We must not give up. We cannot give in. If you are a generation of committed, you got to fight those generations or through generations of compromise. If you have to fight to the third and fourth generation, you and I have got to fight for godliness and righteousness and holiness among the people of God and among your family. We've got to stay engaged in the fight. If you have washed your hands or wiped your hands of the responsibility of succeeding generations, I want to encourage you, get your hands dirty again. Get back in the game. Engage in the fight. Meddlesome. Step on a few toes. Cross a few lines and a few boundaries. Offend somebody. It ain't hard these days. But the last thing you can do, mom, dad, is to wander off into obscurity and not leave a clear path for your coming generations to walk. Because you can make a difference for generations to come. If what you have is real, if you will live out your authentic faith for all to see, and if you will stay in the fight until your last breath is gone. So what generation will you be? Committed, compromising, or corrupt?
We hope that you've enjoyed the message today and that it will be a source of encouragement to you this week. At Champion Forest Baptist Church, we desire to help people make sense out of life through Christ-centered living. And that's because with Christ, we have hope and true satisfaction. The Bible clearly states that all men have offended God by worshiping things He created instead of Him. We have chosen to reject His authority in our life and look for satisfaction in things He created instead of Him, which is ultimately pointless given that He is truly the only thing that can satisfy us completely. He is the perfection of everything we seek. The problem is, though, that once we have sinned against Him by turning to these other things, a gap is created between us, not allowing us to access Him anymore to find this satisfaction. God's character demands that our rebellion be accounted for before He forgives us. And this is the beauty of the message of Jesus. Christ is perfect in every way. He never rebelled against God, and He took upon our punishment on Himself so that we could be reconciled to God and be fully satisfied in Him, gaining eternal life. We need Jesus because without Him, we are without hope, both in this life and for eternity. Turn to Christ alone for forgiveness and find satisfaction fully in our great God. Once again, thanks for joining us today, and we hope to see you soon.